Transitioning to a decarbonised economy sounds like just one change. In fact, this shift requires several transitions across sectors, geographies, and timelines. In Talking Transitions, a new podcast brought to you by the EY organisation and Foresight Climate and Energy, we look at how the transition is affecting three key areas: energy, financial services, and government. The Talking Transitions podcast is out now. Download today from wherever you get your podcasts or visit talkingtransitions.com to find out more.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
As usual, before we start, this is your reminder that you can pick up a 20% discount off a subscription to New Scientist magazine. All you have to do is go to newscientist.com to subscribe and enter the code POD20 at checkout. That will give you access to a whole range of stuff available to our subscribers. It's been great to see so many of you signing up with this code.
Yep, come and join the family. You get access to loads of premium content, videos, features, interviews, and an amazing archive of work going back years. POD20 at checkout on newscientist.com gets you your discount and your membership of the New Scientist global family.
Hello, welcome to New Scientist Weekly, the podcast that brings you the week's most compelling news in science. I'm Tiffany O'Callaghan, I'm New Scientist Features Editor.
And I'm Rowan Hooper, I'm our podcast editor. This week we're joined by New Scientist reporter Adam Vaughan and science writer and former New Scientist staffer David Robson. Hello both.
Hey.
Hi.
Coming up on the show, we have...
Before anything else, our thoughts are turning to our friends in Alberta. Obviously, Fort McMurray being evacuated has been extremely difficult, not just for the province and officials, but for the folks who live there.
That was Justin Trudeau as he was recorded by CBC News back in 2016. But we have David telling us why all the ums and ahs we make in normal speech are not signals of total ineloquence, but actually a sign of amazing language ability. Yay!
Yay!
And we have weird news about a near-Earth asteroid that we're about to land on, or that NASA is about to land on, not us in the pod.
Yeah.
We also answer your COVID questions, and Rowan has a frankly startling story about the penis bone of mammals.
Yeah, that's a massive mystery about why most mammals, and certainly most other primates apart from us, have a bone in their penis. And did you know that it's been argued that the Hebrew word for rib in the story of Adam and Eve, the rib that God takes from Adam to make Eve, that might not refer to a rib. It looks like it's a biblical Hebrew euphemism for baculum, which is the penis bone. So the writers of the Bible's book of Genesis might have put this story in to try and explain why humans don't have a penis bone, but other animals do. But first, Adam, not the biblical Adam, Adam, our own Adam. This was the year we were supposed to get our act together on climate change. But, you know, we've been totally thrown off track by the coronavirus crisis. So, look, tell us how we can get back on track.
Yeah, well, I've gone into about 3,000 words of detail in this in the cover story for this week's magazine.
Right.
Well, as you say, this was 2020. Well, I remember writing the preview for 2020 last year in December, and this was meant to be the pivotal year to close the gap between the 3+ degrees of warming we're on for at the moment and the 1.5 degrees that world leaders agreed 5 years ago we should get to. So, as you said, we've been knocked off track in terms of our attention by COVID. So, a lot of set piece moments have been delayed. We found out in the spring that COP26, the big climate summit in Glasgow, was delayed until 2021. And this year, perhaps even more importantly, this year was the year that governments around the world were meant to submit updated carbon plans. They're called nationally determined contributions, or NDCs in the UN jargon. And so far, only a handful of relatively small countries have done so.
I mean, I know that all of us normal people have been completely waylaid by the coronavirus crisis this year. But inside government and government agencies, how much have people had to take their eye off the ball of the climate crisis?
Well, some boring meetings in Bonn have been cancelled and have happened virtually instead. And yeah, I think a lot of stuff, all the IPCC stuff has happened on Zoom and other sort of virtual formats. But I spoke to Pateri Talas at the UN World Meteorological Organization to get a bit of a handle on what was going on behind the scenes. And he said, well, it's very well understood in those circles that the magnitude of the crisis, if we fail on climate change, would be something very different to what we're experiencing now with the pandemic.
Yeah. And I mean, also people are starting to realize, aren't they, that we see crises all around us that people are very much linking to climate change now. And that's just with 1 degree of warming. So people are starting to grasp what it might be like with 1.5 or 2 degrees.
Yeah, I think it's interesting, isn't it? I mean, I think if you live in Europe at the moment, then this year you might not think it's been, you know, that striking. But if you're in the US this year, it's been the opposite. You know, take some examples like the West Coast fires is probably the most obvious one. You know, the three of the California ones, which were unusually triggered by lightning rather than the sort of dry winds they normally get in the autumn. They were the first, third and fourth largest in records going back nearly a century. And all five of the state's largest wildfires have occurred since 2017, with seven of the 10 most destructive since 2015. This is all partly because they had this big drought a few years ago, and we're now seeing a sort of fallout of that. You know, as you said, this is just what we're getting with around 1 degree. And I guess the interesting thing is, even at 1 degree, it's clear that systems are starting to break, right? You know, you just can't physically get enough firefighters out there to tackle fires of this size. You know, it's just, it's already getting beyond our capability to cope. And then you start layering on, you know, other crises, such as COVID. And that really breaks things. You know, it really means, I guess a good example is the sort of people being moved out of their homes into, you know, places like gyms and schools and having to socially distance so they can't fit as many more people in. You know, that to me is a sign that we're already struggling with the sort of climate change we've got already.
So with COVID, we've seen that the short-term effect on carbon emissions is pretty much negligible, unfortunately. But what about energy use more broadly over a longer term as a result of COVID?
Yeah, so I guess at the start of all the pandemic, a lot of people were thinking, oh, there might be a silver lining and of, you know, on the environmental side. And we found out this week there was a paper in Nature Communications saying that carbon emissions for the first half of the year were down 8.8%, which is like crazy historic decline. But as you say, that's not really going to make a difference in the scheme of things for climate change because it's this big cumulative problem. So on the bright side, our response to the pandemic in terms of the speed and the sort of boldness of which some governments have acted does show us maybe some possible routes to tackling climate change. You know, energy companies are having to respond to changes in energy demand. You know, BP is cutting oil production 40% by 2030. I mean, yeah, it's obviously to do with transport, aviation and other sectors. And Shell had this interesting look at several different scenarios of how things could play out in the response to this public health crisis. So they saw one where wealth is prioritised, the emissions basically keep going up. There's a second where public health is the priority. And in that world, emissions start falling towards the late 2020s. It's worth saying that's too late. We need them to be falling now every year. Until 2030. And the third was a bit bleak and basically saw governments turning inwards in a sort of nationalist type way.
Yeah. What did they say at Shell? Because we go into this in the mag, but give us a taster of what their thinking is.
Yeah. So I spoke to a guy there called David Hone, and he says that it really depends on how long things go on, basically. So it depends how long sort of public health concerns require these sort of big shifts that we've been seeing, such as large number of us working remotely or recording podcasts from home like we are now.
Yeah.
So a year might not be enough to cement lasting change, he said. But imagine if such shifts go on for 3 to 4 years. And he said to me, people might even do renovation for a home office. Then they'd say, I'm not leaving because I've spent money. The whole system starts to change. So he had this sort of interesting point that things flip if things go on long enough because people have sort of got vested, you know, money or time, and that means things change, and you know.
And we've got the next big climate meeting, COP26. That's the UK is hosting that for the United Nations. What's your best outcome that could happen?
Well, the best outcome would be Joe Biden probably winning the election in November, and then the US suddenly gets on board. I mean, you know, I sort of say that a bit flippantly, but that is true, you know, that the Trump administration is not engaged at all on that side. So, you know, that would make a huge difference. The best outcome would be that China delivers on the rhetoric we had from Xi Jinping the other day and actually submits a new NDC. That's the climate plans I mentioned earlier. And they do that before the end of this year. And UK is, looks like it's going to do one as well, and the EU. So the best outcome would be that big major emitters put new plans for how they're going to be more ambitious on cutting those emissions.
That's our sci-fi alert, which even though this is my first time on the pod, I know what it means. It means we've got something in the mag that has already actually appeared in science fiction. What is it, Rowan?
Yeah, this is about the asteroid Bennu, which was named after a mythological bird from ancient Egypt, which is a bit like a heron.
So is the sci-fi alert that this asteroid is going to hit us?
Well, you have to wait and see. It is a near-Earth asteroid. It's a class of asteroids called the Apollo group, and they're all like swashing around about the same distance from the sun as the Earth is. And apparently Bennu has a cumulative 1 in 2,700 chance of impacting Earth between 2175 and 2199.
This asteroid sounds so 2020.
Yeah. Don't be surprised if it just suddenly veers off course towards us at the end of the year. But no, this story isn't about it colliding with Earth. It's about a spacecraft called OSIRIS-REx. It's been orbiting the asteroid and learning lots of cool things. And the thing we talk about in the mag this week is that Bennu had a parent asteroid and it might have had flowing water on it.
Wait, hold on a minute. What does that mean, a parent asteroid?
Yeah, I didn't know that. It was apparently Bennu is a kind of asteroid formed when something smashed into a larger parent asteroid billions of years ago and all the bits coalesce. And does anyone know what kind of class of asteroid this is called?
A catasteroid?
That it should be called that. No, it's called a rubble pile. That's the official name.
That's much more boring.
A rubble pile. And looking at the images of Bennu, scientists have noticed that there are veins on some of the boulders in this rubble pile, and they seem to have been formed by running water.
Oh, wow. Weird.
Yeah. And so the water, we don't know how water could be flowing on an asteroid, but OSIRIS-REx is going to land and take a small sample from the surface of Bennu and then bring it back to Earth to study. So that's going to tell us what's going on, and you can bet that it's also going to be really pored over by asteroid mining companies.
So what exactly is the sci-fi link here?
Well, you know the Bruce Willis movie Armageddon? Actually, it's not about that. That was because in that movie, the asteroid was 1,000 kilometres wide and this one is only 500 metres wide. So this doesn't work. I'm going to go with asteroid mining for the sci-fi link and the Expanse novels by James S.A. Corey. We have covered them on the podcast before, but it works best for this again. We don't have an asteroid mining industry, of course, and we're not going to have one for quite a while. But when we do, these kinds of asteroids are going to be probably targeted first as they're very close by and they're going to be easy to drill into.
So just to go back to that chance of it hitting Earth, that seems like quite a high chance. So what's the plan?
I don't know if there's an actual plan, but I did ask our space reporter, Leia Crane, about this. And I wondered if it might be less of a problem because it's this rubble pile and, you know, you might be able to blow it up more easily. And she said that actually you never want to nuke an asteroid because then you get an unpredictable shower of rocks that just crash down that are even more difficult to predict and to protect ourselves from. And what you want to do actually is blow it gently off its course. And being a rubble pile might make it harder to do that because you could just blow bits off of it.
Yeah, and if we did try and blow it up, you know, inevitably one would bit of it would come crushing down on the White House or something like that symbolically.
Yeah, you always get the Statue of Liberty or the White House or some iconic structure is guaranteed to get hit. Time out. Have you ever thought about making your own podcast? It's never been easier to get yourself set up, especially if you choose Buzzsprout to host your show.
Yeah, we've been using Buzzsprout from the very start. Each week, it automatically distributes your episodes to all of the major platforms like Apple Podcasts and Spotify.
It also has loads of tools to help you promote your show. You get a customizable website, you can track your download numbers, and they even help you find a sponsor.
If you're thinking about giving podcasting a go, we have a special offer code in the show notes that takes you to their website. Signing up to a paid plan by following the link below lets Buzzsprout know we sent you, gets you a $20 Amazon gift card, and helps support our show.
Yes, so just go to the link in the show notes to find out more. Podcasting isn't hard when you have the right partners, although I am burning through partners fast here.
Next up, please welcome the Prime Minister of Canada.
Before anything else, our thoughts are turning to our friends in Alberta. Fort McMurray being evacuated has been extremely difficult, not just for the province and officials, but for the folks who live there.
That was Justin Trudeau broadcast by CBC. That was him talking about the government response to a massive wildfire raging in Alberta. Now, that clip went viral, with many people were gleefully commenting on how dumb Trudeau was because of all the ums and ahs, like there were 50 in a minute. But David, you've done a piece for The Mag this week that just turns the tables on this, doesn't it?
Yeah, totally. So, you know, in the past, like, lots of linguists just thought the ums and ahs and all of these filler words, also words like, when we use that in a sentence, like to mean this or that. They were considered to be almost like these kind of neural errors in our processing, almost like a vocal hiccup or kind of linguistic trash. But actually, there's loads of really good research showing that they're collateral signals or a kind of meta language. And that means that even though they don't have a kind of meaning within themselves, within a sentence, they do help us to coordinate our conversations and just help it to flow a little bit more smoothly. So they direct our attention or they help to kind of flag up when we should be changing course in the way the conversation is going.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I find myself nodding a lot when you're talking, and it's no good because we're remote, but I find myself wanting to say even more than normal.
Yeah, totally. I mean, and it's quite interesting actually, because obviously in scripts for TV programs, you never have ums and ahs. And, you know, actually the kind of artificial intelligence that looks at, that helps us to transcribe things automatically, they just like automatically edit out all of these filler words. And yet we're actually missing something really crucial there about the dynamics of a conversation.
So should we edit back in loads of ums and ahs into this podcast later? Will that make it easier to understand for people?
I can't believe that I've spent years like trying to train myself doing podcasts and TV and radio, trying to edit out my ums and ahs. I've been doing it all wrong.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's so many misconceptions about them. Like, we think it kind of shows that you're less educated. But actually, there's some research showing that more educated people use ums and ahs more than less educated people. I don't know why that is. It could just be this kind of the thing that if you feel like you've got the credentials that prove your intelligence, then you don't have to try so hard to kind of show off your intelligence in everyday conversation. I don't know. But absolutely, I think like we've really neglected the importance of these filler words.
In the feature too, don't you mention the idea that these kinds of filler words, ums and uhs, may actually have helped us evolve more sophisticated language, sort of far from dumbing it down? They've enabled us to become more sophisticated.
Yeah, that's totally the case, actually. So if you look at like other primates, you know, they have like very basic conversational language, but they have like this kind of signaling that they can like kind of call out if a predator is approaching. But you would never have any kind of word like huh to like kind of question the meaning of that. You know, the communication is so simple, you don't really need to have any of these markers. But the idea is that actually these markers are crucial when language does get a bit more complicated, because it helps you to question someone's meaning, for instance, or to kind of show that you disagree with them, or to kind of show that you want them to continue. So something like the mm sound is actually a really good signal that, you know, just keep on talking. And it's actually especially effective because the mouth is kind of closed. So you're not even opening your mouth to speak. You're just kind of subtly signaling that you should carry on with your conversation. Now, the idea is that if we didn't have these kinds of signals, this meta language, then we just couldn't have evolved the kind of complex and sometimes ambiguous structures that we use in language all day, every day.
You touched on this a minute ago, but is there a more ums and ahs used if there's a disparity in the rank, in the social rank of people? So if I'm talking to someone more senior, would I sort of dumb my language down in, you know, and have all these ums and ahs in it? Well, you said the opposite, really, didn't you?
Yeah, exactly. And I think it is the opposite. In that I think actually, like, the more educated you are, the more you feel free to use them. And I think it's a bit like Adam was saying as well, that it's like in your, we're so conscious of there I go again.
I don't know if you're doing it deliberately now,
I've
David.
Never been more self-aware. You know.
Demanding our attention.
But I think we're so conscious actually of how we might be perceived for using these, that, yeah, when we feel kind of in a vulnerable position or when we feel on display, we try to avoid them. But actually, people's perceptions of them really aren't as bad as we think. So one of the old ideas was that if you um and ah a lot, it shows that you're kind of lying because you're having trouble creating your story. But actually, there's now lots of research showing that that's not true. And the more you um and ah, the more you're kind of telling the truth. It's almost as if like you're being more spontaneous, whereas if you have like a lie you're trying to tell, you're going to be more polished. So definitely, I think we need to completely change our opinion of these absolutely crucial elements of language.
It's fascinating as well that if you think of like Google Duplex, you know, the sort of, you know, the computer generated voice of, you know, to make, you know, make your restaurant booking, they've deliberately inserted these, right, to give exactly this, I guess.
I didn't know that, but you could totally see how that would make you feel like you're talking to like a real person rather than a robot. Yeah.
I feel like I'd be annoyed if I heard a robot going, I'm not sure, could you repeat your order?
Yeah, I guess.
But are they universal, David, these words? Did you get them all in all languages?
Yeah, pretty much. And actually, for some of these words, they are remarkably similar. So one of these researchers who's been looking into that is Mark Dingemanser at Radboud University in the Netherlands. And so he looked across 31 languages, which were all quite distantly connected from all across the globe. And he found that every language had the equivalent of a huh sound. And they might not have been identical, but they sounded very similar. And so he thinks huh is almost like one of the most fundamental filler words, because it helps us to just signal the fact that we don't understand what someone's saying, but we do it so quickly and so efficiently that it doesn't create a kind of awkwardness in the conversation. You can do this kind of turn-taking within 200 milliseconds, but using a huh to signal your lack of understanding just passes the ball back to the other person very quickly without any kind of awkwardness between the two of you.
With the, you know, Trudeau speech that famously earned him some disapproval and people weren't particularly impressed, there were so many of them that it seemed like it's not possible that they were all kind of functional. So are they occasionally glitches, or are there cases in which they do actually reflect poorly on us?
Well, you know, with that speech, I think it's interesting because he was asked this question, which he hadn't prepared an answer for it. So he was thinking on his feet. And the ahs and the ums there actually signal something really important. They help to kind of signal that a pause is going to happen in a conversation. So if I just have a pause without an before it, that's actually super awkward to hear because you feel like...
on an audio show.
Yeah, exactly. Like one of the researchers did that to me in my interview and I felt like it was excruciating actually. She left a really long pause because you kind of wonder, well, what's happened? Have I like broken the connection? Or with Trudeau, you might have thought he was being distracted by something else that was happening in the room. But actually, in this case, the ums and the ahs were really helping him to kind of think on his feet without creating that kind of awkwardness. So even though it sounded a little bit, stupid, as some people said, I think actually it would have been a whole load more awkward and it would have reflected a lot worse on him if he'd just left pauses rather than the ums and the ahs.
Next up, it's COVID update time.
Yep, we've been living with SARS-CoV-2 all year, and we've still got a lot to learn about it. And we had a live question and answer event online for subscribers about the pandemic, and we were inundated with questions.
So we thought, as a service to you, we'd answer some of the most common now on the podcast. We answered loads in this week's mag as well, but here's a taster of just a few. Adam, where are we with potential vaccines?
So we are way faster than we've been on any previous vaccines, which, you know, usually take around a decade to develop. We've got several now in phase three, which is the sort of mass testing of tens of thousands of people to find out if there's adverse reactions in, you know, certain subgroups of the population. But the honest answer, Tiff, is we are still probably months away, as much as the Trump administration would like you to think otherwise.
So what is plasma therapy or convalescent plasma therapy? And is that likely to be effective?
So this is the idea that treat COVID-19 patients using blood plasma taken from people who have recovered from the illness. So you get sort of ready-made antibodies to the virus. But the truth is, at this point, we are, despite what has come out in some US news reports, we just don't know whether this is going to work.
And what about immunity after you've had COVID-19?
Well, it seems people are protected against reinfection. The thing is, we just don't know how long immunity lasts. It may only be months. I've heard some people speculate that it might be as little as 4 months. But again, this is one of those things where it's just an unknown at this early stage.
And one thing about masks that struck me is that a growing number of studies are showing that the amount of virus that you are infected with can contribute to the severity of the illness that you then get, and that wearing a mask can reduce the amount of virus that you're exposed to. So I thought that's a really compelling argument for wearing a mask.
I think it is another interesting, compelling argument for wearing a mask. Yes, I've heard it, you know, that question of like the dose, you know, the level of the amount of virus particles you get being slightly less maybe because of face mask wearing has been sort of posited as one of the reasons why, although we're getting a lot of cases again, the death rate seems to be lower. There's a bunch of other reasons why the death rate's lower, but that's been thrown in as one possible reason.
Okay, we've got loads more of this Q&A in the mag this week. Let's just ask one more, though. Look, is there light at the end of the tunnel yet? Or does the tunnel go on and on? Are we going to have to live with this virus forever?
There's two things there, a tunnel and a living forever.
Yeah.
The infectious disease experts I've been speaking to and colleagues I've been speaking to, they think it's likely that, like the existing four human coronaviruses we have, that we're going to have to learn to live with it, that it will become endemic. I mean, you know, as long as we've got, given the sort of social inequalities we have at a global level and the interconnected world we have because of air travel and trade networks, as long as the virus is somewhere in people in the world, the fact it's got this sort of easy transmission by, you know, being asymptomatic in many people means it's going to spread. And even if a vaccine is developed, it doesn't mean that the world is necessarily going to beat or eliminate the virus, because you're not going to give the vaccine to everyone. We don't know how long the immunity lasts, and, you know, new people will be born who need it and so on. So, yeah, we are probably going to have to learn to live with it and adapt to it somehow.
So not exactly the bright light at the end of the tunnel you were hoping for, Rowan.
Sorry.
But let's leave it with that note of optimism. So as Rowan says, there are lots more of these question and answers in the mag this week. So please do pick it up to find out the latest on what we know about what's happening with COVID-19. Now, I was going to say you might need a stiff drink after we discuss this next item, but...
Yeah, there's a lot of potential for terrible puns on this one.
Anyway, go on. This is the story we've all been waiting for.
Yeah. Okay, so this is about the penis bone. I don't know if anyone's heard about this, but most male mammals have a penis bone called the baculum. And when they copulate, the bone slides into the penis and makes a nice straight rod. And it's really common. Probably any dog owner will know dogs have got them. And carnivores have them, lions, cats, rodents, bears, and even bats have them. And most primates have them, even the ones closely related to us, chimps and gorillas, they have a bone in their penis.
And just to be totally clear, it's an actual bone.
Yep, it's an actual bone. And they vary in size and shape, as you might expect, between all those different species. So a walrus baculum is 22 inches long, 59 centimetres long.
Holy hell.
Yeah. So there are two questions here. And one is, what are they for? And the other is, why don't humans have them?
Okay, so taking a wild guess here, are they a kind of sort of natural Viagra, as it were, like a mechanical Viagra. So animals can always be ready and sort of last for as long as needed,
yeah,
with this mechanical assistance.
Right. I think that is what they're for. And if you've ever seen dogs copulating and they sometimes get stuck together, that's called prolonged copulation. And it's quite possibly why there is a penis bone in most mammals. But we've written about a paper in the magazine this week that suggests a new theory that they function in order to remove the sperm from other males.
So that happens in lots of insects, doesn't it?
It does, especially in damselflies and dragonflies. And in those animals, the penis is like a pipe cleaner that removes sperm from inside the female that she's stored from other males.
What if she doesn't want that sperm removed?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, there's lots of things she can do, actually, to avoid that, certainly in insects.
So this seems like quite a tricky subject to kind of investigate. So how do we know that the sperm is removed in these mammals?
Well, yeah, we don't. That's just what they're suggesting by having a look across the bone penis bone shape across 82 species and looking at what that might mean. And they've found a particularly compelling example. The honey badger's penis bone looks like an ice cream scoop, says the researcher. And she says it seems to be designed to scoop out the sperm and then cup the cervix.
Yikes.
Yeah.
Okay, so tell us more about humans and not having a penis bone.
Yeah, so in other primates with a baculum, the males don't encounter females very much. And when they do, they want to copulate for a long time, and then the baculum allows this.
Right.
But whereas in humans, the mating system is loosely one of pair bonding, and males are with females for a lot of the time and can copulate a lot, but for shorter durations. And with human females, you know, ovulation is concealed. It's not like in other animals where it's easy to tell when a female is at her fertile point. So in humans, the male basically has to mate with the female a lot and basically hope his sperm are in the right place at the right time to fertilize the egg.
And to some extent, his ability to do that as and when required is a signal of his quality, as it were?
Yeah. That's right. So the human penis works better when there's good blood pressure and a physical and mental illness and stress. Those things can impact its functioning.
So what do Adam and Eve have to do with all of this?
This is really cool, I think. So a couple of researchers thought it was just weird that the ancient Israelites would think that men and women have a different number of ribs, because, you know, they don't. We all know that men and women have the same number. So why would there be this story trying to say that that women have one fewer rib? And people thousands of years ago would also know that many other animals have penis bones. So the idea is that the biblical story of the bone being removed from Adam is an explanation for why men don't have a penis bone. And the word rib in Hebrew is used several different ways in the Bible.
So according to this idea, instead of women coming from Adam's rib, they instead come from his penis bone?
Yeah. Yeah. Would you rather that or a boring old rib?
Yeah.
Leaving it there before things really get out of hand, that's all for this week. Thanks for joining us, Adam, and thanks special guest David Robson. Do check out David's excellent book, The Intelligence Trap. And thanks to you for listening. Remember, as a podcast listener, you can get 20% off a subscription to New Scientist by using the code POD20 at checkout.
And do get in touch for the chance of a shout out on the show. We're on Twitter at New Scientist Pod, and you can email us at podcasts@newscientist.com. And in the meantime, do spread the word about our show. Until next time, take care. Bye.
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 This podcast is produced by Oli Giu Podcast Production. Find out more at ogpodcasts.co.uk.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.